Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. This week on the Dev Team, Ryan will start us off with the word of the day, community. Then I branch into some news with the latest from GitHub and certificates from the Scrum Alliance. Last, Jake will drop some trivia on us on a game of Did You Know? All right. Well, Ryan, why don't you go ahead and kick us off? You wanted to talk a little bit about one of your favorite TV shows, Community?
Absolutely. Definitely. No, I wanted to talk a little bit about community and not just the dev community in general, but more specifically the importance of community as a junior developer, as a new person to our kind of world. You know, each and everything we do generally has a community around it, and I think it's very important to find a community that makes sense for you. Right? For most of us, that could be people at work, could be folks, alumni from your class, stuff like that. But whether you're learning a new framework or a new language or, you know, completely new approach to software development, there's likely an established community out there already that you can find a place for yourself in. Right? Obviously, they're not all happy, fun places. There's definitely some toxic communities out there. I'm sure you've all been on Reddit. But I think it's important to find a place where you can actually, you know, get insights and gather some help and advice and explore kind of something in a kind of safe environment. And, you know, something that we've been talking about at work recently, we have a lot of internal communities like that. And people kind of just pick and choose and drop into the ones that make sense for them, for the type of software they're building, the type of, you know, language they're using, frameworks they're using, that kind of stuff. And I think it's really helpful for developers, especially new folks, to find a place like that where they can seek out help and stuff.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. 100%. You know, and I think you could replace the word community also with like subculture, right? Like there's a subculture in everything. And I mean, if you don't believe me, just go to the documentary section on my Netflix, right? There's subcultures, there's communities around playing old school arcade games, specifically like Donkey Kong, right? And, you know, it's just interesting. You know, people have interests, right? We have specific professional interests. And with something like software development, there's a lot of different frameworks out there, right? There's a lot of different flavors of how you should write this code, right? And I use the word should kind of, you know, loosely there, because depending on the opinion of the community, it will largely depend on how you technically should or shouldn't be writing your code. And, you know, there's a lot of really great platforms out there. You know, pretty much everyone has a Discord these days. I think the most popular frameworks, React, Vue, Angular, that's the one, right? Sorry, Google. You know, they all have their different, you know, either it's a Gitter or it's a Discord channel or a Slack channel or something of that nature. And you can just jump straight in and actually talk to the maintainers of these big popular libraries, which is super cool.
Yeah, as a kind of a personal experience, when I had to do the talk for VueConf Toronto, like that was even a sub, like, hey, let me show you our way that we do at CodeWorks of writing Vue. And while that was less of a community interaction and more of a presentation, I think that stuff like that you see a lot, and even more so us as a you know, art school and ourselves as individuals, we were a part of several different communities involved in, you know, meetups in the before times when we saw each other face to face.
When everything wasn't so virtual, right?
Whoa.
Yeah. So I do remember the before times as well, where we actually had the chance to network both physically and meet new people, and we'd always start with, oh, you know, who's hiring, and kind of building that network of people. And I think that's the other big thing about community is I would use the word networking. Is you're getting to know other people who have differences of opinions. And I think as developers, that's one of the biggest things that drives, in my opinion, drives success and growth is being exposed to other ideas.
Yeah, definitely. Having an opinion is so crucially important, right? And as you're first learning, as you're first, you know, kind of just acquiring the skills of becoming a software developer, it can be hard to, you know, essentially form an opinion on something, right? Like, hey, I really like the way that this library works, or I really, you know, want to write my code in a specific format. And sometimes it's fun to just say, well, why, right? And when people don't have an opinion, they don't, well, because that's the only way I know how, you know, it's not necessarily an opinion. It's okay if it's the only way that you know how, but formulating kind of an opinion and an idea around why you do something that you do, I think is absolutely crucial when trying to decide where you belong in different communities.
Yeah, I think Mark said it nicely too. I think that, you know, there's a lot of community norms and practices around almost every framework and every language. Not all of these are, you know, hard coded "thou shall not do this" type things. But you know, you look at Python's PEP 8, and you look at how, you know, folks develop .NET and C#. You know, there are common ways of doing things. And as a new developer, as a new student, you might not care about those things. You're like, I just want it to build. I just want it to work and pass the test. And you're like, that's great. But as you move into professional software development, now it's all of the, okay, well, now my code needs to be maintainable by other people on a team. It needs to be readable by other people on a team. And, you know, if you're a 20-year veteran C# developer, and you look and you're like, this doesn't conform to any, you know, notion of normalcy for me, it's very difficult to kind of go, yes, I approved your PR, right? So I think it's important to understand what they are. Sometimes that community is one-sided. You're just a pure consumer. You go to the documentation site, right? You can, you know, read all about it and you're like, okay. But I think it's a lot more engaging when it's a kind of, you know, bi-directional type engagement. You can actually get feedback to your questions and actually, some communities aren't super open to that. You get those kind of, you know, negative Nellies out there to like, why are you asking dumb questions? But I think far more of them are much more open and encouraging to folks who are learning and trying to contribute.
Yeah, no, it's definitely one of those things, talking about toxic communities, right? I think you can simply just say tabs or spaces, right?
I didn't think there was a debate about that.
No, tabs or spaces. Come on, guys. Tabs or spaces.
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 Two. Spaces. Okay, all right.
Wait, I mean tabs. Oh, sorry. I can't be the same as you guys.
No, but I mean, even something as simple as tabs and spaces, right? Like, people can be highly opinionated to the point they're even just mean, right? But when it comes to stuff like tabs versus spaces, who cares? Put a linter on, you know, let your linter solve those types of issues. That's totally fine. But I think in the broader term of concept, it's more human-to-human interaction. You know, let's talk, let's communicate, let's, you know, code in such a way that, you know, we enjoy working on each other's projects and, you know, we don't get hung up on the more semantics or the syntax, so to speak.
And again, circling back to, like, I think one of the biggest things about communities is it's an opportunity to learn, right? There's so many different ways of doing things, so many different ways of solving problems, so many different, you know, microcosms of, you know, even like Scrum and Agile, right? There's a specific, like, here's the way you should do it, but there's thousands of different ways of even just building your product backlog. Like, stuff like that is just, it's crazy. Finding solutions to, some people use, you know, for estimations, t-shirts, and other people use different estimation sizes, and some people don't do that process at all. And if anything, I think that that's something that the more you can be involved in other different ways, the more you can formulate a well thought out and a well defensible opinion.
Yeah, and then eventually back up that opinion, right?
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and move into the news this week. And there's just a couple of quick topics I wanted to touch on. So the first one actually is something I haven't worked with personally a lot, but I think Ryan has a little bit of experience, and that's GitHub Package Container Registry. This is something that GitHub actually released now as of the 21st, which is today, so that's when we're recording this, but it'll be a little bit behind on the release. But GitHub packages actually have been released for public. Everyone's able to use them for free now.
For free, you say? Nice.
So if you're not familiar, the container registry is basically, it's putting the capability of GitHub to hold onto and register your Docker containers to. And so then they can be pulled down and shared accordingly. Is that, you said that's something you guys do quite a bit?
Yeah, so the GitHub package kind of system has support for a lot of different types of packages, NuGet packages, Maven packages, that kind of stuff. The container registry is kind of something that's been in beta or trial, whatever, preview for a couple of months now. We actually have been playing around with that quite heavily for a lot of our tooling is wrapped up in containers these days, so that our devs can just, you know, run a Docker command and get either a tool set or an environment or whatever. So we store them up in the container registry and they can just pull them down, whatever.
So this is a question then. I think this was even on our news last season, is Microsoft acquired NPM, right? Or Microsoft first acquired GitHub and then GitHub acquired NPM, right? And so now seeing these packages being moved into GitHub kind of mainstream, I almost wonder if we'll start to see, you know, the death, so to speak, of the third party like NPM website, and if, you know, a lot of that stuff is going to start migrating just over directly to GitHub. And I kind of almost wonder the same thing with like Docker Hub, right? Is the idea to pull everything into kind of that centralized location? Do we have any concepts or ideas on that?
Yeah, so I think Docker Hub recently changed their pricing model a couple of months back, and I think obviously that kind of scared a few people. They're like, whoa, am I going to start, you know, they're pruning kind of stuff from free plans and stuff like that if you're not using them. So I know that was a concern for people. Now, I'm not sure what the pricing model is around GitHub packages. I'm sure, you know, storage is not free. So if you're storing 4 gigs of container somewhere, somebody's paying for it. But, you know, it's, you know, cloud storage is not super expensive either. So, I there's also the transfer cost, right? If I've got 4,000 people downloading that, it's one thing. If I've got 4 million people downloading it, what does that cost? And who's paying for that too? And I think, you know, I kind of miss the days where, you know, the old Linux days where you could just start your own mirror. I mirror the Fedora binary site so you can get all the packages to, you know, that's the kind of stuff you can't really do with NPM because the package registry is insane.
Yeah,
right?
No, absolutely.
And you don't see too many people doing it with NuGet either, but you do see private repositories popping up. Like, you know, internally we have NuGet feeds where we have, you know, packages for Chocolaty, packages for C# developers and stuff like that. We don't want those packages to be out on the public internet, right? Same with NPM registries and same with Docker registries, right? And I think obviously, you know, with you know, GitHub and Docker Hub, that I get they both have kind of premium options, ones you can pay for and get extra security wrapped around them, authentication requirements, that kind of stuff. So lots of pros there versus some of the free ones. But I don't think the other ones are initially going to go away. I think, you know, there's always that kind of default common ground, like, you know, NPM, right?
Right.
But I do think there's definitely a market for other options.
Yeah, I think that I hope that they stay separated, right? There's a part of me that goes, oh man, it's so convenient they're all in one spot. But there's also that small part of me that's like, oh God, Big Brother, and like one person manages everything. And now what happens if they change? Oh, we're gonna charge for this or that or the other thing now, right? Oh, you want to have your product published here? Well, great, it's going to cost you money. And then now we go back through the process of, okay, well, somebody else now makes a free version, and we just iteratively recycle through that. So I guess that would be more of a fear, is that they go that way. The article that I was reading specifically from GitHub doesn't mention anything of that nature. It does talk about some of the other, how Homebrew has moved to a lot of their containers and stuff, and their bottles, as they call them, into GitHub containers. And so that was kind of the biggest name call out. There was a couple other ones in there, but that was the biggest one I saw. So I don't know. I don't really have insight into that at all. I just kind of have the idea that I hope that it doesn't go that direction from my perspective.
Yeah, you know, I will also, though, push back and say GitHub's pro account being $7 a month, right? Like, it's pretty dang cheap for a lot of the different features that they do provide for you, right? And it's one of those things that I've actually really appreciated as kind of GitHub has scaled up and down. And, you know, at first it used to be you can't have private repos without having a pro account, and now you can have private repos. You know, and the perks of being a pro member kind of almost went away when GitHub kind of opened up so many different things. But at the same time, they supplemented it with, you know, you have so many machine hours, and when you have a pro account, you have like triple the amount as a free user. So, you know, as long as we continue to see, you know, that give and take, I'm cool with what it is.
I think it's also important to treat, you know, binary artifacts like that. These are outputs from a system, right? And I think Docker does a great job of that, because obviously the whole point of Docker is I'm codifying my image. I'm writing it line by line and saying, you know, thou shalt do this, and I can create that image from anywhere. Putting it into a new container registry if GitHub changes the pricing model is not particularly hard. And I think that's the important thing. You know, it's not like back in the day where we would hand tweak a machine image, install all the software, tweak all the registry settings and go, right? It's a lot more automated and built into our pipelines and stuff like that. And I think as long as you treat those binary artifacts as outputs, I don't think you necessarily need to trip yourself up down the road.
All right. Well, the only other piece of news I had is basically a certificate I actually just picked up. And so I wanted to make sure people heard about and were aware, not just for my own personal branding, but the Scrum Alliance has actually, as of April, come out with a second tier for what they had as the Certified Scrum Developer. They now have the Advanced Certified Scrum Developer. And there's a few changes that come with that. First and foremost, the Scrum developer process used to, as a CSD, used to require a prerequisite that you had a CSM or a Certified Scrum Master. And then they modified that a little bit till there was a whole day of Scrum as a part of a 3-day training. And now it's basically you have the advanced layer of CSD. And just to kind of put it out there and make sure people are aware, as you're looking at this program, the term developer to the Scrum Alliance is very different than maybe what we would anticipate is what we would call a developer. And essentially they identify it as anyone involved in the development of an application, including project managers, product product owners and all that kind of stuff. While they do have the CSPO, they do a lot of that actually does include still others. The advanced, on the other hand, does require a good amount of coding knowledge. We had to write a few tests and things like that. So just some kind of growth in that area, which I think is super cool. I think that, you know, even being able to identify, hey, I'm a certified Scrum developer, it can bring people some weight. But maybe as a transition of news and into topic to kind of get you guys involved here, what are your thoughts on just certifications as developers?
That's somewhat of a loaded question, I would say, right? Certainly. Like, some certs are very worthwhile and, you know, highly respected within the industry, and others aren't, right? I think to talk specifically to Scrum, like, so many companies out there say, hey, we're agile, you know, we follow Scrum, we do this stuff, but, right, and that's the famous Scrum but, right? And I think a lot of those kind of deviations from the standard model not only come from, like, variances in team dynamics and kind of the individual needs of different teams, but I think, truthfully, a lot of it comes from lack of education or knowledge in the area of what actually is Scrum, right? And so when you're working amongst a team, and I know that I struggle with this myself, is, you know, I've worked underneath a certified Scrum Masters and things of that nature, and sometimes there's just a general lack of knowledge or confusion as to, like, okay, so, yeah, we're supposed to be following this, like, Scrum process. We're doing our sprints, right? We're trying to do our estimations, but 90% of the team doesn't even really understand, you know, how the underlying system or the architecture or the practice of the project management Scrum Agile lifecycle is even supposed to work, right? And so I think it is a good idea to be able to say, like, here's kind of a more generalized certificate for everyone on the team.
And I think that is kind of one of the goals too, is to take some of that responsibility, because traditionally it would have been, the response to you would be, well, that's the Scrum Master's job to make sure you understand this process. And while, yes, that still remains true, I think it is beneficial, like you said, to have other people go through having done both. I will say, obviously, the CSD is a much lighter version of what the CSM is when it comes to, like, the nitty gritty details. But there is a lot of crossover, a lot of similarities. And just kind of becomes more developer focused. Now, again, the ACSD, that the advanced cert, that certainly gets into more of the here's your specific job. Let's talk about kind of the topics from last week, CDD, BDD, kind of the differences there, how they get applied, and actually writing the code for it, whether it's in you know, one language or another. We, you know, did Jasmine, I think, because most people knew JavaScript, and then something I had to actually learn about, Gherkin, which is an implementation of Cucumber.
I know from a certification standpoint, Ryan, I think you greatly outshine all of us in the realm of certifications, you know, falling largely down the Microsoft stack, if I'm not mistaken.
Only because they made me do them. No, I think, you know, getting into my industry back when I did, you know, the ops side, certifications were kind of a requirement, right? You know, growing up in London in the 90s, if you wanted a help desk job, you needed an MCSE. And an MCSE back then, if you looked at what it was supposed to be able to do, was very broad, you know, manage network for a multinational organization across three continents, that kind of stuff. And you're like, okay, you need this cert to be a help desk person. I'm like, okay. So you go and do it, right? I think from the development side of things, and you know, it's more akin to, I kind of liken it to kind of pilots, right? You can become a pilot, right? You can learn to fly. It's, you know, but then you need to get rated on each type of aircraft, right? And I think, you know, getting language-based certificate, you don't see a ton of them, but there are out there, and some people do ask for them. Some people do, you know, it's a line in the sand for them, and they can go, oh, if you've passed this test, I at least know you've got to this bar, versus, yes, you said you know JavaScript and you've shown me a portfolio. I think developers have that kind of edge where they can create a portfolio, and they, you know, much like an artist, and they can say, look, here's the proof that I can do what I've said I can do, to a point, you know, nobody says you did it all yourself, right? So I don't see as much of it in the software world compared to the ops world. You know, you think the ops world, like every different firewall manufacturer has a cert, every different, you know, server manufacturer has a cert, right? There's HP certs, there's Microsoft certs, there's Linux certs, there's Dell certs. Like, you know, how many? And if you work for a reseller or a VAR or a contractor consultancy like I used to do, your customers expect you to have them. So, you know, a lot of my certs were kind of, just had to have them. Like I can't know, the customer's not going to pay for you to come on site if you're not a certified HP server person. You're like, okay.
Right. And I think we see this in other realms as well, right? You know, it applicable to mechanics is the first thing I thought of when you were talking about, obviously, specifically, yep, you get the Toyota certified repairman and all that kind of stuff. And I think that, again, it probably falls a lot into that realm of, hey, a Toyota and a Chevy in many aspects are very much the same. So certifying you as a mechanic for one versus the other is just paperwork. But again, I think that there are, and Jake will probably push in this direction more, a lot of those security certs. That's where it starts to become of like, okay, you're in a potentially sensitive spot of our business, and I don't want you touching it if I can't validate from some third party that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. You know, in the world of cybersecurity, certs are very highly sought after, right? It's a little unfortunate that one of the most common certs that everyone asks for, even at an entry level, is nowhere near an entry level certification, right? I think the thing that I tend to struggle with when it comes to the fact of certifications is a lot of different certs. It's very easy to do like a cram session for maybe 3-4 days and go pass a cert, right? And that doesn't necessarily show true knowledge, right? But I think the spirit or the concept behind certifications is good, right? If someone actually takes the time to truly study for a certification, you know, kind of get to know more of the ins and outs, then that's great. One of the things that I really like about the Certified Ethical Hacker certification is that apart from taking just a multiple choice, you know, 100 question test, where quite frankly, most of the time you get a 50-50 between most of the answers, that certification in particular is also coupled with the lab, right? And Ryan was kind of talking about this. We as developers often have that, we almost kind of have an upper advantage, you know, upper leg when it comes to being able to show off a portfolio of skills. We can demonstrate that, yes, we actually know this. And with the Certified Ethical Hacker, they actually put you in a proctored session. They put you in kind of a dummy network, and you sit down with another individual and they say, okay, here's your target. Here's what you want to get in. Try to avoid detection. This is kind of what's going on. And then you have 6 hours to perform a live lab with someone, right? And I feel like that is a really good step in the right direction when it comes to certifications, right? Now, of course, that's not a cheap certification, but that is one that it is much harder to just do a cram session for.
Yeah, I would add that to even our own philosophy as a school. And of course, there are people who listen to this podcast who are quite frankly never going to come to our school, and maybe they're in different states or whatever the case may be. But look at that and assess, and we talk about this all the time, competency over completion, right? And that's what you're talking about with the cram session as well, is can you pass the test? Great. But do you actually know what you're talking about? And I think that any type of education or any type of school that is able to assess you on a functionality standpoint, more than a trivia standpoint, is going to give you leaps and bounds beyond, especially like as we talked about in this career field. While certainly you can work with other people, follow tutorials, and kind of fake knowledge in certain things, it will only get you so far, and very quickly it'll be discovered that you know nothing. There are other certs that, again, having had certain Microsoft certs, I know what they test now, and I know just having that cert is not equivalent to actual knowledge.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of that's getting a little easier to do. Like Jake said, a lot of that kind of proctor type experience, that kind of, you know, one-on-one lab-based exams, they're upper-end certs for a reason. They're expensive to run. They're expensive to operate. And so, you know, you don't get your 400,000 people doing them on day one, right? I think I've seen some of that start to change, even some of the entry-level kind of Microsoft and AWS certs now, because so much of our infrastructure is cloud and dynamic. They can drop you in environments and say, off you go. Just you don't have to just click a multiple choice anymore. You actually have to go make it work. The cool thing about that is it means they don't necessarily care how you make it work, right? There's lots of ways to do things in the AWS console, lots of ways to do things in the Azure console. You could go do it through the web browser. You could open up the Cloud Shell, type in the CLI command. As long as you get to the state they were expecting to see, you're going to pass the test. And I think that's both good, because, you know, a lot of those tests, when you used to have multiple choice, it's like, well, I would never do it that way. Well, yeah, you know, it's like, it's very much like you said, Mark, the vendor's way. What is the vendor answer, right? As opposed to like, what would you maybe do in the real world? So I see that changing through technology and stuff like that. I think that's kind of nice. I still think, you know, proctored one-on-one labs are really great, but they're also very, very high tier certs for the most part.
You triggered me something that horrified me, and I remember doing this, is several years ago I took a certification for, like, I think it was like PowerPoint or Word or one of those like Microsoft just products. And basically it was like all hot zone clicks. So they didn't have a true UI, but it was like, oh, access through the ribbon this process. And I'm like, ah, oh, that's like 10 clicks. It's right here. I just have the shortcut right here. No, no, you gotta do it. No, if you clicked in that spot, you failed. You had to do it in the specific process. And I think that those evaluate next to nothing. I think that, though, I'm glad to hear, you know, kind of what you're talking about. And this is where even, we'll move on after this, but I just want to kind of throw this last little bit in from a, and this is completely left wall, but hopefully related enough, interview process. When I'm interviewing somebody, I want to see that you can actually write code, build something. I don't need to evaluate you on some esoteric, can you, you know, reverse, write me a search algorithm or, you know, binary search or stuff like that. I don't need you to write a, you know, sort. I don't need that. I need to know you know how to code, not just write some memorized algorithm.
I think that's exactly what we're talking about here. Like, if you're trying to make the hiring decisions purely off of certifications, I think that's a fool's errand, right? It's also, I will admit, incredibly difficult, though, to assess someone's true knowledge and skill in maybe a 30-minute interview, right? And so that's something that, you know, if the industry as a whole is going to shift away from, you know, go write up a search algorithm on a whiteboard, right? Well, then what do we shift into, right? If we're not just going to blindly trust certifications, what do we shift into? And that's not necessarily the discussion that we need to answer
next
today.
Next week, deep dive.
Yeah, potentially next week is, you know, best practices around actually hiring, making those hiring decisions. But, you know, it is just one of those things that, as with anything, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
So for clarification, was the news there was a new Scrum Alliance cert, or was the news you passed it?
You pass that?
I'll talk about that. Yeah, no, I definitely passed that. Yep. So
congratulations, Mark.
Thank you. Yeah, very, very congratulate.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for me. Jake, we'll kick it over to you.
All right. So let me fire up these questions here. I thought it'd be fun for the deep dive today is to actually just kind of play a little trivia game, right?
Super excited for this.
Oh, dear.
And the trivia game, kind of the spirit of this is more like, hey, did you know? Here's just some kind of cool things. And then, yeah, here's a little bit of industry knowledge stuff. And, you know, some of it is maybe kind of more advanced concepts, and other stuff is like, you know, maybe as my first kind of foray into the world of a software developer, I just started at a company and I've never even heard of these terms before. So what the heck is that? Okay.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And Justin, if you could just push the button to mute everybody but me, and then I'll just answer. And if I'm wrong, I'll just edit that part out.
I think we'll be okay. Now,
I wasn't at a disadvantage already.
I tried to pick things mostly in your guys' wheelhouse here, okay? With maybe the exception of this very first one, this is just kind of general knowledge, and I feel like it very important to kind of lead us off with, can you tell me the name of the famous person, right? The child of a famous poet and English mathematician who many historians consider the very first programmer.
No.
Can you not?
Oh, was this...
I'll give you a hint. She was born in London.
No, I know who you're talking about. Wasn't she like dating Charles Babbage or something? I don't know. That's her name.
She was the daughter of a lord.
Yes.
Lady something.
I don't know.
Okay. You'll recognize her name the second I say it.
Liskov?
No. No. Not Liskov. This lady is much older than Liskov. As a matter of she was actually considered the very first developer before we even had computers.
Yeah. I'll definitely know as soon as you say it.
And she developed on a computer that didn't exist because the computer, as was spec'd, couldn't be built at the time.
Absolutely. And so more than anything, Ada Lovelace.
There right, you go.
See, we recognize the name. Just a very famous mathematician, truth be told, right? And she was able to actually come up with like programming concepts, development concepts before we even had computers, which is just kind of a cool shout out, kind of cool thing. And I thought it'd be fun to kind of start us off with just a little bit of a history lesson. So, you know, no points awarded for either of you. But
I'm going to get schooled tomorrow by my tech friends for not getting that right.
So let's get into something I'm sure you guys will actually know. We all use this on a daily basis, but can you tell me what it actually stands for and potentially what port it is? What is SMTP?
Simple mail transfer protocol, port 25.
There we go. All right. Well, there's a point there to Ryan. And so,
oh man, you got the applause track.
I specifically picked one here that I figured Ryan, you absolutely would know. Definitely. Kind of the entry-level networking knowledge, but something in the world of development, right? We actually, we write applications that utilize SMTP all the time, right? We build applications around email. We understand how it works as developers, but sometimes we don't understand the underlying technology, right? And so my point or my call out there is just specifically, it's impossible to know it all, right? And we have different specialties for a reason, right? And so it's not one of those things where, I would generally pull in a random developer and say, hey, tell me what SMTP is, right? But if I'm pulling in a network technician, you probably ought to know some of that stuff.
Yeah, I think also these days you see a lot of that abstracted these days via like API calls. Like most developers don't need to know about SMTP anymore because you're likely making a API call to Twilio or something, right? And you're saying, send my mail for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, all right. So here's a little more developer-esque question here.
I think he means I'm supposed to get this one.
In SQL or SQL, depending on your subculture, your community, right? SQL. What are primary and foreign keys?
Are you looking at me to answer this?
I'm asking either of you for 1 point. Ryan is currently leading, by the way.
Oh well, the primary key is the key on the table. Foreign key is a reference to another table's key.
Yeah, and what would you use primary and foreign keys for?
Pretty much relationships.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Or ultimately, you could identify primary keys could be used for indexing, sorting, improving search algorithms, stuff like that.
Yeah. And so, again, there's another kind of call out there. Like, as a software developer, we probably need to understand a little bit more about keys, relationships, how our data is actually tied together. A lot of times we're using, like, ORMs or things of that nature, right? And so even in this realm, like, Mark, you're not a DBA, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Not that I recall.
Yeah. So, I'm sure that this knowledge around primary and foreign keys can run actually quite a bit deeper, especially when you start stepping into things like indexing and hashing and things of that nature, which it does. But from a developer, standard application developer, understanding how the foreign key relates and how the primary key relates, is definitely deep enough.
Allow me to introduce you to my friend, NoSQL.
That means it doesn't have SQL, that's all.
NoSQL just means if I don't know SQL, then I know the other thing.
Yeah, you
right?
know NoSQL.
Yes. And so.
Touché.
And that's actually an interesting question. When we talk about NoSQL, right, we're talking about document databases. Ryan, since you brought it up, how do NoSQL databases manage relationships then?
Poorly.
That's the correct answer. a lot of times, depending on the type of document database that you're using, you probably have like an object ID. A lot of times in memory, we can tie objects together. Kind of use like linked lists and things of that nature. And so a lot of our indexing, a lot of our hashing is based upon actually pulling those databases into memory.
And for a lot of intents and purposes, from a developer standpoint, functionally, you're going to use them very similarly, right? And so I think that that's where you get that knowledge. And it's like, oh, this is a foreign key, and this is a local key, and this is an object ID. They're just the same. They're not. Right. And you and I know, and obviously there's, obviously you're talking about the deeper end of the hood stuff, but from a surface level, a lot of like super entry level junior stuff, it doesn't matter. It's the same concept. You're using it to establish a relationship from one collection to another.
Fair enough. Although I know many DPAs that would probably,
be real mad at that.
Absolutely.
Statement.
Yeah. Be furious.
No. And you're not wrong, but from that junior developer, what their job is, they can think about them the same.
I agree 100%. So, all right, next question here. We are currently tied 1-1, right? here's one that I'll actually be surprised if either of you know the answer to.
Oh, great. Questions.
I'm quite curious because I guarantee the underhood technology or the top-level technology you guys use, but can either of you tell me what a generator function is?
Function that generates... Next question.
Almost. That's almost actually a perfect answer. Ryan, do you have any knowledge around generator functions?
No, I like Mark's answer.
Yeah, so we're both good. Yeah, I'll choose his answer.
So generator functions, let me use kind of a different wrapper for these generators. Have you ever wondered how async await works?
Nope. I know how it works.
Every time I use it.
So async await is actually just kind of syntactic sure around what is a generator function. And a generator function is it's a function that rather than returning a single value, it returns an iterator, right? And what we learned from kind of our more advanced languages, you know, when we were dealing with things like IEnumerables, under the hood we have an IEnumerator, right? And essentially what we're getting back with the generator function is an object that can point to the next item in the stack, right? Or the next item in the list. And so when you're writing a function in JavaScript, right, and I'll use JavaScript as our language here because that's what I think most of our listeners use. If you actually use function and then splat or star or asterisk, however you want to, you know, specify that character, you can actually define and create your own generator functions so you can build your own concepts around kind of async await. And essentially you get back an object that allows you to step into the next thing. And so a keyword to kind of tie into if a generator function is actually being used under the hood is the yield keyword. And I know for a fact that, especially a lot in game development, we used yield quite a bit in the Unity game engine.
Yeah, yield wait for seconds.
Yep, absolutely. And so absolutely what that's doing is it's actually just returns an object that can be thrown into kind of an event loop and says, hey, I know when I need to fire next. And so, yeah, that's a generator function. So a little bit of a knowledge drop on you for, you know, just kind of one of those things that, although you don't necessarily need to have an in-depth knowledge of how it works, I think it's a cool little nugget to kind of be aware of.
He spent all day looking for that
question.
Yeah,
no, I'm pretty sure he's like complex hey, developer there's a terms reason why most developers don't know.
There's a reason why I'm the host. okay, all right, so...
Go ahead.
Yeah, so next question. I believe there's 2 points to me now. so here we go. Here's one that we kind of, in light of last week's kind of topics, we talked about BDD, TDD, right? Can either of you tell me what regression testing is?
So regression testing to me, I guess, is... writing a test once I found a fault. So I find a fault, I write a test, I don't run into that fault again.
Yeah, it's repairing broken code, or essentially by, instead of test-driven development where we write the test, write the code to pass the test, and then fix the test, this is, I have bad code already, let's cover essentially legacy code.
So yeah. What you're saying is regression-driven development would be the bare minimum you would expect.
Correct. Or hey, so people before me made a lot of mistakes. Now I have to go and fix those mistakes, and let's put a test around those.
Absolutely. You know, that definitely is kind of one of those tie-ins. It's as you're developing new features, sometimes new features will break old features, right? And if you don't have tests around that and you push into production and you've implemented this brand-new cool thing, but you've broken all the legacy code, well, you probably should have had some regression testing done, right? And so, yes, I will award a point to each of you for that one. Excellent job.
Good for us.
Yeah.
Out of your pool of two? Okay, excellent.
okay, so here's a question. This one I'm going to throw specifically at Mark.
Oh, great.
We'll see. Here we go. What answers these questions three? What worked, what didn't work, and what will we do differently?
This will be retrospective.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. That is the sprint retrospective.
I prefer the four L's.
The four L's, I don't know if I'm familiar with that.
Live, laugh, love, and lie.
Well, that's good too.
Wait, what?
The four L, we use the four L's in our most of our retrospectives. It's, liked, lacked, learned, and longed for.
Huh. Yeah, that's pretty good too. Nice. I've never heard of that.
I always have to pause and think for a minute, honestly. Like, and I think that this is probably for a lot of people in Scrum. Okay, is this the retrospective or the sprint review? And again, a big distinguisher, a big identifier is the sprint review is always specifically code-based. What are the actual physical functionality? What did we solve? What is the functioning iteration of the app? The retrospective is more of how do we what are our, I feel cheapening it this little way, but what are our emotions around the process that it took? What could we improve? What did we do well? What did we do wrong? And again, how can we improve the next cycle?
Yeah, the retro is also kind of an internal ceremony. It's for the dev team, whereas the review can also include stakeholders and customers and stuff like that.
Would it be safe to say that the retrospective is more around like the squishy human emotions and the review is more around the deliverable? Is that correct? Or
yes, but I think that cheapens it a little bit in regards to the retrospective. So yes, this is more the squishy human emotions, but also how are we effective as a team and how are we not effective? Sometimes it's not just emotions. Sometimes it's like, hey, I don't work well with, you know, Ryan because he's in a different time zone than me or something like that. And
has
so,
a weird accent.
Yeah, it's the accent. Right? I can't work well with Ryan because of, you know, conflicts that aren't necessarily interpersonal, but just some external factor, right? I work much better effectively as a part of a team on site. So I'm better in the building working with people who are also in the building, right? So it's not just emotions like, hey, you were mean to me or anything like that. I feel like that deeply cheapens what the retrospective goal is. It's just how can we be more effective as a development team?
Awesome. Okay, so here's a term that I think gets thrown around quite a bit.
And I get a fake point though, right?
Absolutely, point to Mark.
Okay.
So I believe the score is, I have no idea, because the points don't matter here. again, kind of one of those words that gets tossed around quite often, and I wonder if people even really understand what they're saying when they bring it up. But so I'm going to pose this to you, is what is and what is meant by software assurance?
Pass.
Ryan, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's when I pay Cisco the yearly fee to make sure they keep giving me software updates.
There's actually quite you're not quite wrong, right? Software assurance is the level of confidence that software is free from vulnerabilities, either intentionally designed into the software or accidentally inserted. Right. And so software assurance is one of those things that basically says, hey, when I push, how confident am I that nothing's going to break? Right? How confident can we say that when you are about to use this program, it's absolutely going to work, right? And this is something that I actually just, even to this day, I find myself sometimes just thinking and looking at these different projects and, you know, looking at these different web applications and services that now exist and saying, holy crap, I can't believe that that works every single time, right? Like, it's just absolutely amazing. You know, software assurance is one of those things that can definitely be hard to achieve. But it's one of those things that, like, hey, we promise that this thing is actually going to work, right? And so it's one of those concepts for me that, you know, how do you get to that point where you can confidently say, yes, I'm going to deliver software that works?
And is that specifically around functional requirements, or does it include quality attributes?
Oh, yeah. Did it talk about the behavioral requirements and expectations, Jake?
You know what? I don't know. And if we're in the Monty Python skit, I think I'd be launched off the bridge right now. I think that's just kind of one of the neat things about software development is the fact that it is an iterative approach. It is something that we can build. And as we introduce, you know, this continuous integration, continuous development, we need to make sure that our software assurance, you know, that we're not breaking things is actually working, right? And I think a lot of that comes into the infrastructure that we have in place around our different applications.
So Jake, can you identify for me and I'll wrap you out here this way. Can you identify me the difference between an iterative process and an incremental process?
One is iterative and one is incremental.
Oh, great. So a good reference, and I actually saw this kind of defined in this way, and I thought it was really nice and kind of an interesting thought about it. So incremental is how your images used to load when you had dial-up, and that is essentially one row at a time. Crisp, clean, but one row as it slowly loaded the image. Whereas incremental is essentially how we load images now, where we start with kind of that low-res, kind of grainy image, and it slowly gets more and more and more defined and more functional and more clean. And so a lot of times when we're talking about taking an iterative approach versus an incremental approach, the iterative approach says we start with that functioning app. Out of the gate, we have a functioning app. It has low functionality, but what does function works, and we continue to improve and grow on that while maintaining and cleaning up kind of that core functionality. Whereas an iterative approach is, hey, I built this chunk of code. All right, cool. I'm going to leave that alone and start a whole new chunk of code and then a whole new chunk of code, and it's just new every iteration. Essentially. So it's kind of a linguistical difference in a way to kind of think about those is incremental is what we used to do where images loaded slowly and iterative is now what we do when images load slowly.
Fair enough. All right, so I have one final bonus question for all the points on the board. There are animated moving pictures that we have on the internet. Are they GIFs or GIFs?
The G is silent. It's HIFs.
I choose no comment.
Yeah, I'm gonna not. I'm a GIF.
Line in the sand. You have to.
I'm a GIF guy. Graphic GIF.
Okay, Ryan.
Yeah,
you don't have to.
I'm a GIF guy.
I love the memes. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Despite the fact that the creator of the GIF has said that it is actually formally pronounced GIF, I think he's wrong. It is GIF.
Yeah.
So that is right. That is absolutely my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
So we all get the points.
All the points are reawarded to myself. I win this game. Thank you for participating.
All right.
Ultimately that
Soundboy wins.
That
yeah,
will wrap
Soundboy,
us up for
yeah,
sure.
Soundboy. he's cheering himself on, I think, at this point. So, yeah, there he goes.
There he goes. A little slow on the uptake there, though, but. Thanks again for participating. I thought it would just be a kind of a fun way to introduce a lot of different concepts as we kind of talk through some of those things and, further dive into those concepts as we go on.
Well, and hopefully we get some comments on this this particular episode. We can learn all about your GIF memes and make those fun quotes and comments around your little video clips. And after that, we'll go ahead and finish it off.
That's a wrap for the dev team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want Kun Code, wash your hands.